Blog Talk Radio.
He's one of the most gifted and versatile actors in the history of film. He's delivered a series of masterful performances in many of our most iconic films, like The Godfathers 1 and 2.
The shot saw me on the causeway. He's dead.
Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory.
Tender Mercies.
I guess it's no secret how I feel about you. A blind man could see that. Would you think about marrying me?
The Apostle.
Give it to me tonight, Lord God Jehovah. If you won't give me back my wife, give me peace. Give it to me, give it to me, give it to me, give me peace. Give me peace.
All leading up to his Oscar-worthy performance in his latest film, Get Low.
About time for me to get low.
Actor Robert Duvall. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everybody. I went away for a little bit there. Can you hear me now?
What happened, man?
Yeah. I guess I pushed the mute button twice. Okay. Welcome, everybody, to a very exciting episode of Movie Geeks United tonight. We couldn't be happier to bring you this guest tonight. We've been after him for years. Robert Duvall, of course.
Right.
It's an exciting interview for us to bring you. You know what? I've always been told, just to get this out of the way, because several people have asked me in email and through our profile, is there a relation between you and Robert Duvall?
Mm-hmm.
I have been told since I was a kid, he's part of, like, a distant part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never verified for me. So before the interview, I looked back at our family tree, and I have, you know, dozens and dozens of names from way back, and there's no connection. But in case there's anyone out there that might be related to me that I don't know about, here's some of those names. Jimmy, Edward, David, Carolyn, Dorothy, Mandy, Hoyt. All right, there you go. Just send me an email if you happen to be a family member. So how are you, Jerry?
I'm doing fine, you know. You know, we've been, like, kind of going at it the whole weekend, but we had a great day yesterday with Nancy Allen. And I'm can't wait to bring that in September, that interview. It was really good.
Yeah, it's a fantastic group of interviews that we're bringing you guys. It's a Brian De Palma tribute series. We're paying tribute to six of his thrillers the first week of September. And that'll be exciting. And this Wednesday, we're going to have a very special show entirely revolving around movie trivia. So anyone that wants to call in and take part in a movie trivia competition against another listener or in collaboration with another listener, it's less adversarial that way. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun doing movie trivia, and it's going to open in a very special way this show Wednesday night. We have film composer Austin Wintory and filmmaker and film score enthusiast. This guy knows everything about movie scores.
He does.
Yeah, Amin Mataka, and they are going to go head-to-head on Name That Score. So we're going to play snippets of film scores. And that's going to be their trivia contest that they play against each other. That's going to be fun.
That is, yeah. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. All right, Jerry, here's a little game. I'm going to name a Robert Duvall movie.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll name one, and let's see who can't go on first.
Okay.
Okay. To Kill a Mockingbird.
The Great Santini.
Apocalypse Now.
The Outfit.
Oh, The Godfather.
Wait. The Godfather? I'm going to go with Days of Thunder.
Something to Talk About.
He was in that? Oh, my God. The Road.
That's right, The Road. Network.
Crazy Heart.
Phenomenon.
He was a Phenomenon? Jesus Christ, I got to pee.
Yeah, he played the town doctor, the best friend of Travolta.
That's amazing, because I honestly, God, I showed you how much I remember of that movie. Yeah, that's just crazy. The Killer Elite.
Very good. Tomorrow.
Well, that's very good, too. Wow, that's incredibly good. You know what? I don't have...
Come on, man. There's only about 100 more.
I know there are 100 more, but I don't have any on the, I'm not looking at IMDb or anything, so I'm just doing this all from the memory banks here.
Well, The Apostle, Assassination
the Apostle,
Tango.
Sling Blade, thank you.
Very good. Okay. Tender Mercies.
Ooh, Tender Mercies, that's a good one.
For which he won the Oscar.
That's right. It's like, I can imagine you like just having like Will Ferrell in that before he won the Oscar. Oh, speaking of Will Ferrell kicking and screaming,
is the game ending now?
Yeah, kicking and screaming.
That's right. He was in that. That's right.
The soccer or the kids soccer movie or whatever. Yeah,
that's exactly right, man. That's a good job. Okay, can I think of another one? There's so many of them. Lonesome Dove, of course.
Oh, dude, that's a good one. Let's see, what else? THX 1138.
Oh, very good. Very nice. Broken Trail.
Now, let me ask you, was that a TNT Western?
That was maybe 8 to 10 years ago. Well, it was when Thomas Hayden Church came back to prominence after... Sideways, because he was his co-star.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let me see if I can... You know what? Actually, a long time ago, he was on an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that. I just remember it was a very... It was one where there's a... I think he becomes part of a painting, or he escapes into a painting. But it was a good one. But that I remember that.
Well, you can go with that. That can be yours.
Okay, is that good? All right, cool. Oh, Dean Treadway, come on. Okay, Dean, why don't you call in and
Open Range.
Oh, that's a good one. Let's see what.
I swear.
Into this decade, we're already the decade that just ended. Wow. Oh, let me be a real cheese bag here. Get Low.
Well, that's a perfect segue to begin our interview. Get Low. We'll stop the game now. I won't torture you anymore.
Thank you. I'm just doing this off the top of my head.
But I guarantee we'll go on IMDb and check his page, and we'll be like, why couldn't we think of that off
of
the top? You know.
But I don't remember Phenomenon at all. But I don't remember the movie really. I know I saw it, but that's about it.
It was just on TV cable last week, and I rewatched it. And there's always like one moment, the catalyst moment for most characters he plays.
Oh, I got
in
one. A Civil Action. There you go.
Steve's Alien. Very good.
Thank you.
But let's get back to Get Low. That opened Friday. It's playing in select theaters, and I'm sure it'll expand as the weeks go on. It is a terrific new movie. Robert Duvall, Bill Murray, Sissy Spacek. Duvall's wife thinks that it's the best movie he's done in 15 years since The Apostle. Duvall is really hot on the film because he really believes in it. It's the kind of material that he feels a real connection to.
Right.
And so we spoke to Robert Duvall about Get Low and about some of these iconic characters that he's created throughout his career, and here's what he had to say. Enjoy it, everybody.
What can we do for you, sir?
I'm after a funeral.
Boy, are you in luck. Solid pecan, steel handles, whatever you want.
Party.
A what?
A funeral party. And I want to be there.
You will be, I guarantee.
I want to be there now.
Alive? You want to have a funeral party while you're alive so you can go?
Yes or no?
Yes.
I everybody to come who's got a story to tell about me.
I heard the most awful things about him when I was a kid.
How do you get people to come tell stories about you that I'm guessing might get them, you know, shot? Is it just me, or is he extremely articulate when he wants to be?
We have a plan.
We're going to run an ad in some papers about your party.
You want me to look like this,
Jeff?
A crazy old nutter draws more.
Oh, for heaven's sake. 1,000 years ago, he was the most interesting man I'd ever met. I wondered if you were still under that beard.
Wouldn't know where else to go.
Mr. Felix Bush from Sirius Herman from Caleb County. How are you today, sir?
I am.
40 years. We shut yourself off like that. Now, why would you do that, Mr. Bush?
Come to the funeral, maybe you'll find out.
He has a way of making people do what he wants.
Truth is, nobody knows what he's capable of. Maybe even he doesn't know.
Yeah, what are you going to do now?
I've done a lot of things in my life, but I've never done this. Many of you have heard stories about Mr. Bush, but today I'm told that we're going to hear another kind of story. His.
About time for me to get low.
I love Get Low. I was really moved by the film. I recall hearing you say that when you first read the script, it reminded you of the writing of your good friend Horton Foote. What was that quality that you found similar?
Well, kind of, you know, rural, kind of, I don't know, very poignant and humane and human in certain ways, you know, through the characters. You know, it just kind of reminded me some of, I wanted him to see it, but he didn't live long enough to see it. In fact, he died one day when I was giving that final speech. We got the word that he had just died at that moment.
Mm.
Very strange.
His family saw it recently, didn't they?
Yeah. His daughter and son-in-law saw it the other night. I think they enjoyed it very much. We didn't talk too much about what it was like her dad's work, but I felt somewhat it was like her dad's work. You know, I mean, he would have enjoyed it very much, Horton, had he lived to see it.
You can't have a funeral if you're not, you know, deceased.
Hold on now. Here's the detail. We can look at it.
Pretty big detail.
You want to have a funeral party while you're alive so you can go.
Yes or no?
Yes. Buddy, get some paper. We need to make a list of who Mr. Bush wants to invite.
Well, sit down there. I want everybody to come who's got a story to tell about me.
All right, say again.
Probably covers about 4 counties.
Then I want 4 counties worth of people at the party.
Well, sir, the thing is, how do you invite people? How do you get people to come tell stories about you that I'm guessing might get them, you know, shot. You know what? Don't worry about it. You go on ahead. Don't worry about it. We'll come up with something. A couple of ideas just came to me.
Like what?
Tell me about that big climactic moment in the film, which, as you were shooting it you got the call about his death, but what is it like to shoot those scenes? Do you sense an extra kind of pressure to deliver in those moments, because it is kind of the climax of the film and that character?
We did it in one take.
Mm.
They put up 3 cameras in one take, and I had kind of lived with those words for a while, you know. But when we vacationed in northern Argentina over Christmas, I would sit and look out at the Andes Mountains and work on that, and it gave me a sense of solitude and peace and quietness, you know. So when I finally did it, it was very much a part of me.
Mm.
So I didn't feel any pressure or anything like that. I felt just this was the time for that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your process and your preparation when you receive a script. Do you feel that it's changed at all or evolved at all since you started?
Well, I guess there's similarities, I suppose. I think that
I'm more offhand now about it and a little more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't worry about if there's an emotional scene to be dealt with. It doesn't bother me as much. I know that it'll happen. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Sometimes not that I plan it particularly, but I figure if I want something important to happen, that if it happens, it's going to be on my terms, and I'm not going to tell like the director or other actors that I might do it necessarily. So,
right.
You know, the different ways that it can go, and I let it go. I let a scene go in the way it seems to go logically. And
mm-hmm.
I'm a little more relaxed maybe with the whole process than I was in the beginning of my career.
Well, you come from Sanford Meisner training, and that kind of specified living in the moment.
Yeah, I think anybody who trains or works with anybody, they stress that. Yeah, I think that was stressed when
mm-hmm.
I spent so long since I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse, you know, that was emphasized definitely at that point, as I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a moment when you feel, take for instance, your character in Get Low, is there a moment that you feel that you've got the character?
Yeah, I felt that going in. You know, we put on Kenny Diaz put on a brilliant beard, and you know, I just you inch along, and you know, I feel it. I feel it wasn't foreign to me. If
mm-hmm.
if I had to, not that I worked for that. If it could be an offshoot or an echo of one of my uncles or my father's people from Virginia, kind of. You know, not that I worked for that, but. I didn't
yeah.
feel that it was something that foreign to me that I couldn't just reach out and grab it.
Right. But you've played such a variety of characters, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them. But in finding the character, is there usually one key to unlocking what that character is? For instance, say someone like Stalin?
Oh, boy, yeah.
But
Stalin, it was tough because we filmed over there within the Kremlin, and that was the toughest, but in a way, strangely rewarding. There wasn't much footage on him. I actually kind of went with the rhythm and speech pattern of one of my old landlords in New York City,
hmm.
you know, who had been from the Ukraine, who detested Stalin, but... you know, I kind of went from that and built on that, you know. That was, I in a strange way, I enjoyed it very much playing Stalin.
You're fantastic in it. And another film that I really love that you're in is Wrestling Ernest Hemingway.
Well, what I did with that was I got three guys I put on tape, Cuban guys, and I would only go to Cuban restaurants. I would only eat Cuban food, Cuban dessert, and only hang around with Cuban people try to get a sense of that, you know, and the music and everything like that, you know.
You eat one of those every day?
No.
You were eating one yesterday, right?
Yes.
And you're telling me you don't eat one every day?
Yes. I eat two every day, one at 10 o'clock for my breakfast and one at 2:30 for my lunch.
And lo and behold, if I had never done that, Terry Gilliam has approached me to play Don Quixote in his next film, if they get the financing. Had I never done that part, he would have never offered me that, the part of Don Quixote. But that was a very rewarding. I worked very hard on that part of in Wrestling Ernest Hemingway. I liked it very much.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's terrific. I want to ask you a couple of questions about some of these films, which are iconic. Starting with the obvious, The Godfather 1 and 2.
Right.
Was Godfather 2, was that a different experience for you than the first?
In what way? How you mean, like the whole working process?
The working process, because obviously the first one was riddled with kind of chaos from studio interference, and Coppola was on shaky ground, and yeah.
Yeah, well, but see, the thing with the first one was much more fun than the second one, because Jimmy Kahn was on.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, and he was a lot of jokes and fooling around. Coppola would say, come on, guys, we got to be serious now. But we were always fooling around, which was good, which gives you a relaxation on the set, you know.
Yeah.
So actually, the first one was more fun, and the second one was a terrific film, but, you know, it was more down to business, so to speak, you know. We did it up there in Lake Tahoe and places like that. But each one, you know, they were both such just terrific films. Wow.
Did you have, when you create a character like a Tom Hagen, and obviously you weren't part of the third Godfather, but do you kind of imagine a life beyond the film for that character? Do you have an imagination of where Tom Hagen, where his character went to after part two?
Well, you usually think of before, but yeah, you could somewhat after, yeah. You think more in the present, though, because I had a friend of mine, Louis Cosentino, who from East Harlem, he didn't know him well, but Carmine Tremonti was kind of the guy who was one of those five families in New York, and he said there was a guy that was like a high-paid gopher that followed him around and lit his cigarette, pulled his chair out, a position that couldn't be demeaned by others, but that was it. So I kind of went from, that gave me the key kind of like a mafia version of a, I don't know, FBI guy falling around. Not FBI guy, but, you know, like somebody falling around a president being a gopher for them, you know. So that was like a key to me, you know, and hanging around and being in New York, that you kind of sop up that atmosphere.
Right.
But, you know, you just go, you don't intellectualize it too much. You think about it, but it's more, you go with instincts and nice little stories you hear that kind of spurs you on in kind of in a fun way, you know, in an enthusiastic way.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of listener questions for you, and actually, a couple of them involve Mr. Foote and your work with him.
Right.
One of our listeners, Dean, wants to know. He says, "I still think one of your best performances is from Tomorrow." Which was by Horton Foote. Is there still a lot of Foote's work that hasn't hit the screens, and are there any plans for you as producer or actor to make those a possibility?
Oh, none at all, none at all. I love the plays off Broadway recently that I saw, The Orphan. That was just brilliant. 9 hours. We sat through 6 hours and then three another day. I just don't know if they're going to film them or not. But,
yeah.
No, and like I said to someone before, If I'd only had a career with Foote's work and with what I did with Coppola, it would have been a wonderful mini career. You know, I've had many more. But those two guys, you know, it was terrific. And Horton was, you know, how many people he was a friend for 50 years. How many people you have for friends for 50 years, you know. Whatever they can put on film of Horton's is great. You know, Hallie Foote, his daughter, maybe she has plans. I don't know. I would certainly hope so.
Yeah. I know that one of your favorite role is Augustus in Lonesome Dove.
That's
what? Tell me about what makes that character and the arc of that character particularly special to you.
Well, it's the kind of guy that said, you know, I mean, he loved to be with whores, you know. He had his own respect for women. He said, how come we killed off all the people that were so interesting to begin with? And you had 6-7 hours to develop the guy. He was just a very unique kind of guy, and it was special. I was fortunate in the last part of the 20th century to be the two biggest film epics in American history, Godfather 1 and 2 and Lonesome Dove, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked into the dressing room one day, and on the Lonesome Dove, I said, boys, we're making the Godfather of Western.
I walked this earth my whole life with my pride. Now, if that's lost, then let the rest be lost with it. Because there's certain things my vanity won't abide.
Well, I guess you're going to want a fancy funeral too, ain't you?
I've been thinking of that. I have a favor to ask of you, and I'll do you a favor in return.
What favor?
I want you to bury me down yonder. Clara's Orchard.
Clara's Orchard? I don't recall seeing she had one.
You remember that little grove of pecans by the creek you stopped at back in Texas?
Back in Texas? Tell me how you back to Texas. Well, we just got to Montana.
I know where we just got to, little girl. I'm the one dying here, ain't I?
Well, I imagine Claire'd be glad to give you a place in that little family cemetery she's got there. That'd make you feel better.
You mean you'd bury me next to that dumb horse trader she was married to? Hell, why didn't you just throw me out the window right now and be done with it?
Texas.
Yes, Texas. That's your favorite of me, and that's my favorite of you, too. I'm giving you a reason to go off on another adventure so you don't get bored being a rancher, which you ain't one anyway.
You're one of a kind, Augustus. We're going to miss you.
Even you?
Even me.
Actually, the novel was so great. My ex-wife said I read a novel I like better, as good or better than Dostoevsky. It was a great novel, and we tried to come up to that. The Godfather novel was average, and he went beyond it. I think that overall, The Godfather was, from A to Z, was more fully realized. But as you use the word, the overall arc of Lonesome Dove just carried it. And it's like the Bible in Texas. Other places, too, but from Canada down, I hear Gauchos watch it in Argentina. But in Texas, it's really like the Bible for people. Families gather and watch it each year for like the 20th time, so it's really special there.
Yeah. Oh, I know of people that watch it several times a year, and they adore it. They get a lot out of it, and it's
yeah. My wife from Argentina, she still hasn't seen it. Maybe it's too long.
Really?
Maybe something. I say after I'm gone, you know. Yeah.
But you came, you kind of came to prominence in that 70s era of kind of the auteur filmmaker. We had a lot of brave, daring voices like the Coppolas, and you were with Peckinpah and Sidney Lumet and several terrific directors.
And Robert Altman.
Absolutely, yeah. What do you think about the quality of motion pictures today and that kind of the voice of the auteur filmmaker, the renegade filmmaker?
I guess it's outside the establishment now. Then it was inside the establishment. A film like Get Low would fit very well into the 70s. It holds its own, I feel. And it's my wife's favorite film I've done since The Apostle 15 years ago. And but, you know, going back to then, you know, it's like now it's easier to raise $100 million than it is $10 million. And the $100 million movie may go down the drain anyway in the back of their minds. So the big action and all that, but it's like what was in the system in the 70s seems to be outside the system now, and people making, you know, independent films, there will always be that, and in other countries, you know, I mean, I saw a film about, it's about a year or two, I saw it about 4 months ago, La Nana, the Maid from Chile, beautiful movie, what a beautiful, it fit into any era, you know. I don't know if it won awards, but it was better than some of these films that win these foreign awards. So that anybody that can pick up a camera any place in the world can make a movie. That wonderful little movie, The Apple, by the 17-year-old girl from Iran. I love that movie. So, like, you know, anybody can do it. So it's open for all. Going into the 21st century, it's a real, you know, in, hip, open medium for all to pursue.
And that's a beautiful thing. But at the same time, you have people like just what you mentioned earlier, Terry Gilliam, a true kind of visionary filmmaker that has to scrape by to find any money for his movies.
Yes, and I just read a script recently that he wants to do soon. I don't know if he can. Billy Bob Thornton's written a script about the South. I tell people he put Tennessee Williams in the back seat. It is so brilliant, this script. So hopefully he gets the money for that, you know.
Oh, I hope so.
We'll see.
So when you watch one of your films, and maybe Get Low is too fresh in your mind, but when you go back and watch your films, can you watch them objectively and separate yourself from the process of making it?
I guess so. I guess I can. I don't go back and watch a lot of my films. I see them once, maybe twice, and that's it. Some of them I haven't seen. Most I have seen once. I guess I can do that and seeing maybe the growth, hopefully. And but you know, sometimes when I see myself on TV, I'll pass over it. I don't want to see it I'm superstitious. Maybe if it was good, maybe it's changed and it's not good in the year. So, like, it depends on the, you know, it depends on the film. And, you know, maybe someday I'll sit down with some of them and watch them again, you know, and take the time to do that. Maybe if I do the Terry Gilliam thing, I'll sit down and watch Wrestling Ernest Hemingway. The accent will be a little different, but still be a Latin guy, you know.
Right, right. So you're in Texas now. You're shooting a film.
Yeah, I'm going to start a film next week with the same young man that was such he's talented, Lucas Black. That was in, and he's actually a scratch golfer. I don't think there's ever been a movie about golf where the actor that really hit the ball, I mean, really well. This kid plays in tournaments all over the place. He's wonderful. So it's a movie about golf, kind of a faith-based movie. It's a nice, very nice story called 7 Days in Utopia from a book. So I'm looking forward to doing it. We just got here the other day. And I like Texas a lot. But when we got here from California, it was just as hot here as it is in Virginia, my lord.
Yeah, yeah. It's I'm in Florida and it's burning up here. So outside of that, the possibility of the Terry Gilliam film and the Billy Bob Thornton film and lots of possibilities out there.
Yeah, and maybe outside possibility is a brilliant script to Hatfields and the McCoys by Eric Roth that maybe. And then there's another wonderful script like a latter day version of The Guy in Lonesome Dove that's been around for a while. The same writer. You know, that did the adaptation, and a young French director is obsessed with doing it, a Texas project, so why not? Called The Night in Mexico. A sensational character, my lord, it's wonderful. So, you know, there's some wonderful things now, as good as ever, but it's the matter of the financing is difficult to find these days.
Well, I can't wait to see those come to fruition, and I think the world of your work. It's meant a lot to me in my life, and I thank you so much for it.
Well, thank you, Jared. Appreciate the call, sir.
All right, that's Robert Duvall, the legend, here on Movie Geeks United.
That was awesome. That was great.
Thank you, man.
That was really awesome.
The movie's called Get Low. It opened on this past Friday, the 30th, and it'll be around a while. I'm sure it'll expand in different markets throughout the weeks.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I unmuted my line, this gigantic thunderbolt shot through the sky. I'm so afraid that it's going to take out my power.
Oh, is that just the theme of the last couple of weeks with all?
Yeah. So if that happens, the show is kind of kaput. But we have our third movie geek on the line, Chris. Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's up, guys? Just heard the loudest crash of thunder I've ever heard in my life. So.
I know, because Chris lives in the same town as I do,
right.
For those that don't know. It's not like an international thunder bolt that shot through the sky. Did you guys ever see Wrestling Ernest Hemingway? Do you guys remember that film?
I remember watching it on cable, like, in the mid-90s after it came out, and, you know, he's just always good. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is, he's always good. But I was surprised what he said, though, about it, though, that he took a lot of time with it, because it seemed so came to him so naturally in that.
Yeah. He and that's a Randa Haynes movie, and she was behind Children of a Lesser God and The Doctor, and you don't hear that much about her from her anymore. But she made some great films back in that period. But you, when you think of Robert Duvall, you think of the earthy Southern characters. But then you know, it kind of to just categorize him in those. It slights his talent because he's a transformative actor who can play Stalin, Tom Hagen,
right.
a Cuban in Wrestling Ernest Hemingway. And
Assassination Tango. I wanted to bring that up before we went.
Yeah, which is another great movie that that he wrote and directed and starred in. Just one of the most versatile guys out there. And that's why he's had a career for, you know, 40, 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, longer since To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, it's 50. Isn't it 50 years? Isn't it like really?
Well, To Kill a Mockingbird, if that was his first, that was 63, was it? Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
any thoughts on Mr. Duvall, Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. He's so versatile. Yeah, we do, I guess, think of him as playing the sort of mild-mannered Southern characters. But, you know, he can also play a real convincing son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And I think that's the mark of a really good actor. I mean, anybody can play a bad guy and just be a bad guy. But he played, you know, Great Santini leaps to mind.
Yeah.
Just a complete hateful son of a bitch in that movie. And then you can go, and then he hops over and does something like Tender Mercies or, you know, his character in Open Range, Spearman, that's a personal favorite of mine. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm just really proud for the show and happy that you got an interview with him. That's really awesome, you know, very cool.
Thank you, buddy. We got a call online. He's been holding for a while. I think it's a Wisconsin number. Caller, are you there?
I am here.
How you doing?
I'm good. This is Rex Sykes. I was trying to get into your chat room, and I'm on my cell phone, and so I can't do that. But I love the show, and I had wanted to talk to Robert because back in about 1976 or 1977, I introduced Robert to a guy named Steve Siganoff, who was his lead character in a documentary he did on gypsies. And I was hoping to find out more about that film. It was one of Robert's, I believe, first produced films.
Yeah, he has started to get into producing. He executive produced this new one, too. Yeah, Low. I'm sorry. It was a pre-recorded interview. That's why I didn't pick it up during the interview. I'm so sorry.
No, it's quite all right. I mean, it was a pleasure to listen to. You guys do a great job. I'm happy to have been able to tune in.
Thank you so much,
thanks,
man. We really appreciate it.
Oh well, just keep up the great work, and thanks. It was wonderful to hear.
Thank you, Rex. Have a good night.
All right, we'll talk later. Bye bye. Thank you.
Bye bye. Okay, that's Rex. Thank you for listening and calling in.
He has a podcast that he does. That he's been around for a while. So that's cool. This is really good. Rex Sykes is listening. Wow. Okay.
Before we get off on the topic of Robert Duvall, and I didn't mean that the way it sounded, what would be your favorite Duvall performance, Jerry?
It's a toss up between Apocalypse Now and The Great Santini, to be honest with you.
Yeah, The Great Santini is fantastic. I'd be hard pressed. I'd probably put The Great Santini there too.
Mm-hmm.
Chris?
Oh, sorry, I didn't know it was my turn. yeah, obviously, Great Santini's up there. You know, like I said, Open Range is very, very up there in my book.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hard to discount The Godfather and Godfather 2. I mean, Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Just keep on coming with Robert. And, you know, The Apostle, holy shit, like, what an awesome.
You know, I think I changed my mind. I think I'd choose The Apostle.
That's an incredible movie, an incredible performance. You know, even he's one of those guys who shows up in cameos in a lot of movies, too. Like, he got that cameo in Sling Blade, a real, like, haunting cameo as Carl's dad.
That's a great scene. That's just a
Just a scene. He can make the most of having very, very little. I don't think there's anyone that's more versatile than him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the same thing with
class.
The Road, didn't he?
Yeah, he had that
scene in The Road.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a funny story to tell. I dated a girl years ago who wasn't so bright, and Chris, you know who I'm talking about.
you haven't narrowed it down enough yet for me.
Oh, God.
But it was around the time Sling Blade came out. And we went to see Sling Blade together, and that scene with Robert Duvall, and Billy Bob Thornton goes in. Robert Duvall plays his dad. He says something about, you know, the grass is getting high, I could mow it for you, and that was like one of the few lines that they shared during that scene together.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everything happens after that. Sling Blade, you know, he defends the child, and he gets back into the institution and everything, you know, a whole life happens beyond that one scene. And so we get out of the theater, we're driving home, and she says, I wonder if he mowed the grass.
Oh, what a dumb bitch.
That was terrible.
Oh, my God. But
I laughed for hours on that.
Yeah,
that,
no,
know.
That's... no, but Chris brings up a good... The open range role is a very good performance. I mean, really definitely tops, especially the scene in the general store where he...
Yes, yes.
That's a great scene.
Store.
That's an incredible scene.
Talking about the chocolate and how it's here the whole time. You never get even tried it, you know.
Yeah.
The movie sort of gets a bad rap because Kevin Costner's in it. And listen, I think Kevin Costner has the acting chops these days of a cardboard box. But, you know, like, luckily he doesn't say much in the movie. And Robert Duvall does most of the talking.
Yeah,
that's true.
But I remember, I mean, Kevin Costner really chased Duvall for that movie. Before he even wrote the script. So he knew that his involvement was essential to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was.
So let's talk about what we've seen lately. Chris, have you seen any new films? Or?
No, I haven't seen any new films. I did see Adam Resurrected.
Oh, you did watch that?
Yeah, I did finally watch that, which was a movie that we had heard about for years and sort of had then sort of sought after and finally got it off Netflix. And after having seen it, I understand why it just sort of disappeared. Like, it was such a good idea, and I love Paul Schrader's movies, and having him work with Goldblum, like, seems so inspired with this, you know, like, real, like, tragic Holocaust story from a, you know, from a famous novel. It all seemed perfect, but, wow, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work at all. It's just, the movie's a mess, like a complete mess. You almost never have any idea what's going on. I mean, you get the broad strokes, you know, like that he's in this institution and he sort of wants out and stuff, and he's obviously crazy and scarred from this horrible experience, but the movie just doesn't work at all, which is why it died slowly on DVD, in my opinion.
Well, how was Goldblum?
Goldblum's actually, it's interesting. I mean, he's good in it. He's very Goldblum. Unfortunately, it's not a movie that...
He's very Goldblum.
Well, yeah, well, you know, the thing is, Goldblum, when he first came onto the scene, he was kind of a real actor, and he did real parts. And then in the last 10 years or so, maybe even longer than that, ever since the Ian Malcolm character in Jurassic Park, he sort of just plays these cartoony characters.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he shows up in a Wes Anderson movie and all this kind of stuff, and he always just seems cartoony. That's why I was so excited about seeing him work with Schrader, because who is more of a realist? That was more of a realist than Schrader, you know, like in-your-face, gritty realism. In this movie, Goldblum is, he's insane, you know, and so he's sort of playing a cartoon again. And he also sort of loses his German accent in the middle of sentences sometimes. It's really bizarre.
Wow.
You're right. I think that should be on T-shirts and bumper stickers. He's very Goldblum. I think that's a new catchphrase.
Well, unfortunately, he's made himself into a character in the last.
He is. He's been playing up the eccentricities instead of, you know, finding it within the character if it fits, you know.
Right.
And he has one of those very specific speech patterns when you talk to him like we have. I mean, you think Christopher Walken, you think Goldblum, but in a very different way with Goldblum, because his speech patterns are accented by just this exuberance, you know. You can tell he's just so excited, he's almost jumping out of his skin at these thoughts that are coming to him. That's what it feels like with him. I mean, I like the guy a lot. I like his passion, but is he a very specific kind of actor that something really has to be special? I mean, does he demand for his particular set of skills something a lot more specific than another actor would?
I think so. Because I haven't even noticed it in his work in the last 13 years, really at all. I know you've noticed it in Pittsburgh. You were very fond of his work in that. But for the most part, like, I've been you could say The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, I really liked him in that. But it's a very cartoony sort of performance, and it doesn't really require him to do anything other than, you know, play Ian Malcolm or the guy from Independence Day or anything else. I do think that he requires someone who really sort of get on his ass. Like, I can't imagine that Cronenberg, you know, would put up with that.
He wouldn't.
Sort of a half grin in every shot, and, you know, that was a real character and a real performance that required some little, you know, vocal tics and eccentricities, the Seth Brundle character. You don't need it in every performance. And he didn't used to do that. So,
Yeah, the Big Chill and the Big Chill and that, those kinds of performances were a little more straight.
Chris, let me ask you this. Has the quirk become the performance?
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me. It seems like we were saying earlier, it seems like it started with Jurassic Park, I would think. I mean, maybe the seed was there with some of his earlier performances. He was always quirky.
Mm-hmm.
But it started, I think, with Jurassic Park in a trend that sort of never stopped after that. You never really got another real performance, not one that I can remember anyway after that. Sort of been playing hitting the same note. And I love that note. I like him in Jurassic Park. And I he's the most entertaining part about Independence Day, and I like him in the Wes Anderson stuff. But other than those sorts of things, a lot of it is sort of blending in over the
past. Right.
You know, even when he's in something like Igby Goes Down, which is a straightforward movie, he comes in and he's this like sort of over the top eccentric character that doesn't fit into that movie really. The character
Yeah, and I like Igby Goes Down a lot, but it's like he comes in, it's Jeff Goldblum. It's not the character.
Yeah,
it's
it
Jeff
doesn't
Goldblum.
Feel like it doesn't feel like this Godfather character to the child. Like, it just feels like Jeff Goldblum, and it's sort of distracting in a way.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah, I understand what you mean.
I was really interested in seeing him on stage doing Mammoth, because I would be interested in hearing what he does with that kind of language.
That would be very interesting.
But he was so perfectly suited for The Fly, because you think Seth Brundle, that character, obviously a scientist, so the eccentricity is built into that character. I mean, he becomes a fly. I mean, what could be more eccentric than that?
Yeah.
But and then you think of his stuff on with Jurassic Park and The Lost World, which The Lost World, of course, is I think anyone would probably agree a lesser film than Jurassic Park. But if you think about how Spielberg used male actors earlier in his career, like he always had to have kind of an everyman, and Richard Dreyfuss was his everyman several of those high-profile picks. And Richard Dreyfuss has his own set of eccentricities that come across as extremely comical and endearing.
But I think he's able to turn it off a lot better. He can turn it off quite a bit better.
Yeah.
I feel like Jeff Goldblum isn't able to turn it off in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but, and then Independence Day. I mean, and who would have thought that, first of all, who would have thought before he did The Fly that it would be such a revelation? Well, nobody expected The Fly to be such a revelatory movie before they saw it, I'm sure. Or that he would come back with such a burst with Jurassic Park and Independence Day. He was in like the highest grossing movies ever for a period of time there, in the 90s. You know, that was a resurgence for him. But Paul Schrader movies, some of them are pretty impenetrable anyway. But you always kind of cite them for these vivid performances, these visceral performances. So, I mean, I'd be interested. That was the main draw for me, and I'm sure it was for you too, Chris, to see that combo together.
It was, and it just doesn't quite work as well as it does. Like, the best Schrader scripts and Schrader films are completely immersive, and they sort of sink you into this very dirty bath, like Taxi Driver and Autofocus come to mind, a couple other, Affliction is another one. But this one just they sort of show you the bath, but you don't feel submerged in it the way you do with some of his other movies. It just doesn't affect you in that way. And actually, that was, you know, something people complained about at first when they saw movies like Taxi Driver and Affliction and Autofocus, like, oh, you feel dirty when you're watching it. But when you become a Schrader fan, that's what you come to expect from a Schrader movie. Mm-hmm. You want to feel dirty when you walk out of it. You want to feel that. And I don't think that's what he was trying to do here, just like it wasn't what he was trying to do with the Exorcist movie. And I guess what I'm saying is he needs to try and do that more often, because that's what he's really good at.
Right.
Stanley Kubrick in the chat room brought up an interesting point. I'd heard this before. The Fly was actually a reference to the AIDS crisis in the 80s, some people say.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of transformation and degradation, and, you know, people are afraid of you, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be certain that that absolutely was informed by the movie. And it's something to ponder, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be something that's more read into it than what was intended. But movies are, and we're finding this out during our Brian De Palma interviews, movies are so much of their time that's as valid as anything. I mean, sometimes the director's take on their own movies is just as valid or not as valid as as what the audience gets out of it, you know?
Right,
it becomes a different thing at that point.
That's true. A perfect example of that is Inception, you know? There's a lot of different takes on that movie, and all of them seem valid. They can't all be the same one shared by Christopher Nolan. You know?
Right. But they're all, I think they are, with a film like that, with its vast scope and everything, I think the different interpretations are valid, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can recognize the AIDS parallel with The Fly also. I think I can see it. In fact, it surprised me a couple years ago when Cronenberg came out and denied it, because it did seem so obvious in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the Schrader movie that I would recommend, that I've recommended endless times on the show, is Hardcore.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Definitely.
George C. Scott.
I mean, that the influence of that film is just never goes away. You see that in so many recent films, Soderbergh's Traffic. You see it all over the place, actually. I mean, the film hit a lot of people. You just see that storyline repeated over and over in different guises, but yes.
Well, speaking of a storyline repeated, Jerry, did you see the remake for Dinner for Schmucks this weekend?
Yeah. And it's all good until you get to the dinner. When you get to the dinner, the film dies.
The actual Dinner for Schmucks is the weak part.
I do believe that. But this is a film they've been talking about remaking. If I'm not mistaken, The Dinner Game is 96 or 97, the French one. But they've been talking about remaking this, as they did with a lot of foreign films, to remake them as soon as they opened. And it just, you know, I think the first half is actually very funny, but then when you actually get to the dinner part, it falls apart. I mean, it literally just, I think, collapses. You have all these interesting things going on. I like Paul Rudd, and I like Steve Carell, and I actually think they have great chemistry together. But once you get to the actual dinner, I think the movie just loses it.
How?
In the sense that how should I say this? There's nothing really, the things that, you know, you have these, it's actually rather, you know, as in the original one, it's very mean-spirited, but by the time you get to the dinner and you reveal what's going on, I don't think it's very funny. The worst episode of Laugh-In was better, if you will, than when you get to the, as opposed to the dinner. But the dinner itself is just like, you're building up to this, and it's like really nothing to write home about. It's not outrageous. It's not anything. It's just like, okay, you guys ran out of steam.
Well, that is what I hear, that the original, the French film, it was French, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was very mean-spirited, and in Americanizing it, they made it a little bit more white bread. You know,
they muted it. They sweetened it, which I don't mind, but they sweetened it so much to the, you're like, wow, okay. And you feel, you do feel, you know what's going on immediately, you know, and you're just like, I don't know, it's just like I said, I mean, and it's like, you know, you want to watch a good Paul Rudd movie, watch Role Models. That was on last night. Go watch that instead. That was much better. That was a lot funnier, I thought.
I did laugh at that.
Yeah. Wow, we got that out of Jamie. Wow, okay.
Occasionally I laugh at movies.
No, they even laugh at Role Models, though, which I thought was a far superior film. But okay.
I went to the theater and actually watched Role Models. I thought I laughed
that,
a lot.
Oh, the theater?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Okay, wow, that's a revelation.
I was the one. Is Paul Rudd kind of like Vince Vaughn in that he's probably a really great, capable actor? I mean, I think he is.
Oh, he is.
But he's stuck in a genre of outrageous comedy now that he's not getting out of.
I think this one maybe, because I liked him in Role Models, and I liked him in, I really liked him actually, and I Love You, Man. But let's not forget, he was in The Shape of Things, and he was perfect in that.
Yeah.
And that movie is just perfect on so many levels. But
well, and Vince Vaughn was in the remake of Psycho in the prime gig, but he's been in a dozen outrageous comedies since then.
Yeah, he seems to have this thing about holiday comedies, especially lately.
Well,
yeah.
I can tolerate that stuff if they go and make stuff like Diggers, the movie that Paul Rudd went and made 5 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
if they go and make stuff like that in between, that's fine. You know, I mean, Cary Grant didn't make nothing but To Catch a Thief and North by Northwest. He went off and made bullshit like Houseboat, you know? So I don't mind Paul Rudd. I mean, talking about the differences between Dinner for Schmucks and Role Models and I Love You, Man, maybe you could say one of those movies is, you know, a B-minus and one of them is a C-minus and one of them is an F or whatever. The point is he plays the exact same part in all three of those movies and several others that he's done. And like I'm saying, I can forgive that. That's fine. I have no problem with that as long as he makes some good stuff in between there, too.
He seems to be – I will give you this because I was thinking about this weekend. You know, it's like Jim Carrey goes off and does Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and it probably is the best part of his career. I would have to say I love The Truman Show and I love Man on the Moon. And it actually helps the silly comedies he does for the most part after that. Adam Sandler does Punch Drunk Love, Rain Over Me. And the movies he does after these are absolutely wretched. I think we would all agree that the comedies that he's made since Punch Drunk Love have been, you know.
I would add the comedies that he made before Punch Drunk Love.
Well, no, the comedies, but sometimes it helps, it brings something, those great roles bring something else into those silly comedies, but for Adam, it's just like, my God, I just really want to, I'm like, I have a welfare office, I'm going to help all my friends out. Basically.
Well, what you're saying is Jim Carrey goes off and makes Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and True Romance, and he's no longer happy making The Mask. He needs to make a comedy like Yes Man that is a slapstick comedy, but also has a little bit of a heart to it, too, and a little bit of a story and a little bit of originality. I see your point. And, Adam Sandler did not learn that lesson from Punch Drunk Love. I think Adam Sandler actually got the opposite message, which is, Punch Drunk Love sucked because nobody went and saw it.
Right.
I think that's probably how he feels
about
it.
That's the impression I get. I get the impression that he kind of bad talks the serious movies that he does, that people cherish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm under that impression, too.
He says, all right, I'm sorry about that, man. I'm coming back to the movies that my fans like.
Right. Here's my scrotum. You know, like, a midget's going to use it like a speed bag. And then, you know, like... And that's it. And then we're going to get six more of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, will Ferrell ever come out as a serious character actor, do you think?
Well, he tried it. He tried it, but he didn't really try it. I mean, he made stuff like Stranger Than Fiction and that Winter Passing movie. But in both of those, he really didn't step out of that Will Ferrell shell. Like, I mean,
he's quirky in Winter Passing. Winter Passing is a great movie, but... You know, they made a big deal. They emphasized a lot of the wrong things when they were promoting that movie. Will Ferrell had a small part, and yes, he wasn't as crazy as, let's say, Ron Burgundy or, you know, Elf, but it was still,
a funny part.
He was a comic relief in a very serious movie, but he, you know, Stranger Than Fiction is slightly more serious, but we're still waiting for it. I think you're absolutely right. We're waiting for the serious part.
Well, I guess you can't say that if he has those chops to do that, people would take him seriously. I think people would if he's able to do it, because, I mean, Jim Carrey did the most outrageous stuff, and people definitely took him seriously and were able to believe him in a movie like Truman Show or Man on the Moon or Eternal Sunshine.
Right.
Well, maybe Will Ferrell is not capable of that. Maybe he just knows he's not a serious actor and can't. Maybe that's why he hasn't done it, you know. And also, like, you know, I mean, Jim Carrey was working with Michelle Gondry and Charlie Kaufman and Peter Weir and Miloš Forman when he went off and did that serious stuff. He wasn't working with Mark, what's his name, that made Stranger Than Fiction, who's a, you know, a solid director. But I think if you're going to really step outside the box like that, you've got to work with somebody who's a professional who's going to make you up your game. Like,
no, that's true. No, you're absolutely right. I think for Stranger Than Fiction, he is probably the most serious minded we're going to get from him. It's interesting you bring up Winter Passing, which is I think an excellent movie, but you know, it was, like I said, they marketed it as a different kind of film. The problem with that film is they centered everything around him. Well, he's not in the film that much, first of all, and it is like you said, it is the comic relief of the film.
Yeah,
right.
But little family dramas don't make money. And
no, they don't. It doesn't matter what who's in them or who makes them.
Right.
They don't. But it's a great little film.
And the other guys just got the reviews for the other guys just came out, and they said it's, you know, they seem to be saying it's a step above Cop Out, but it's another kind of buddy cop movie that is so tired and so laughless and lifeless.
I don't know. I have a hard time believing that because I saw a 4-minute clip montage from the movie yesterday that was very, very funny. And I read the Variety review was not quite that harsh. The Variety review was somewhat kind.
I just referenced Variety and Hollywood Reporter. I think it's Hollywood Reporter that said, like, the laughs take the back seat and another tired.
But
Steve Carell, like a movie like Dan in Real Life, Steve Carell, I think, can do that.
Yeah.
And Little Miss Sunshine, he's already done it.
Right.
In successful films.
Yeah, very successful.
Yeah.
In the case of Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to see a lot more of that kind of thing from him. It is something because it's often talked about how comic actors are very good dramatic actors as well. There's this kind of inner sadness. I mean, everybody goes into the psychology of it. They go a little too deep, I think. But you know, we see it time and time again with people like Robin Williams and, you know, and the people that we've mentioned. So it's just about opportunity. And there's also this. The reason why Vince Vaughn, Paul Rudd, Will Ferrell are doing these outrageous comedies and not branching out as much as they might otherwise into other kind of fares, because this is what people pay them to see generally, and this is what generally is offered to them, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, we do that, too. It's like what you say. We typecast them in one sense at the box office. But Vince Vaughn did early on, did branch out. The Locust, to a lesser extent, Clay Pigeons. And I thought he was very good in those roles. But that was the 90s, though. That's the old school was the thing that really brought him back to prominence, and he's great in that. It's a very funny movie. It's a very funny role. And then we get, what is it, the one with Paul Giamatti, the Christmas movie, and then the one with Reese Witherspoon, Four Christmases. We get a lot of those. So
yeah. I just wanted to say, if anyone's tuning in for the Robert Duvall interview, it played during the first half hour of the show. Once our show concludes, give it about a half hour or so, and it'll be available for replay anytime. You can listen to it at your heart's content over and over again. We encourage that of you.
Yeah, we want that.
Yeah, exactly. And welcome everyone to the chat room tonight. We really appreciate you joining us. And Alan Levy, the CEO of Blog Talk Radio, is in here with us too. So thank you for tuning in. So Dinner for Schmucks, you saw that. You didn't quite like it. What were the other releases this weekend? Anything of note?
Well, we were talking earlier. It was Charlie St. Cloud and Cats and Dogs too.
You didn't go see the new Zac Efron or Cats and Dogs?
I didn't really have any desire to.
You know, I was telling Jerry, Chris, that I was watching a promo film on Cats and Dogs, The Legend of something, Kitty Galore, I think is what it's called. And they're going through all these voice actors that they're interviewing them one by one, and they go to, like, Neil Patrick Harris, the guy that just hosted the Tonys from Will and Grace, Sean... Can't think of his last name. Bette Midler. And then they cut to Nick Nolte. I guess Nick Nolte does the voice of the movie. And there he is. He's saying, "Cats and dogs living together is a good story." And, you know, in his grovelly voice. It's hysterical. Have you seen photos of Nick Nolte on the set of his new movie, which is the remake of Arthur?
No, I've seen photos from that set, but I've not seen any of Nick Nolte. In fact, I didn't even know Nick Nolte was in it.
Yeah, he plays, I think, probably Butterman from the original.
Butterman.
The driver of Arthur.
Yeah, his chauffeur.
Oh, really? Really?
Wow. He really...
And then Helen Mirren, I believe, plays Actually, I don't know if it's Butterman, because John Gielgud's character was Bitterman, wasn't it?
Oh, it's Bitterman. Okay, yeah. So, I don't know.
I don't know. Bitterman.
I don't remember it in a while. I love that. I love the original movie. Yeah.
So Helen Mirren plays his personal kind of the one that he depends on the most. So it's they've changed the sex of the role from John Gielgud to Helen Mirren.
Sure.
You didn't care. You didn't care for that first one, did you, Chris?
Arthur.
Yeah.
No. No, I don't care for it. I feel like it's very, very dated. Like, I mean, it's like listening to an Air Supply album to me. Like, it's just,
let me ask you this: is it because he's just he's a drunk? Does that get old after a while?
I think that Dudley Moore was a gifted actor, but yeah, I think it's a little bit annoying after a little while. It's like, all right, like, okay, we get it. You're a little drunk Brit, you know, and you're rich and all this kind of stuff. And I don't really, Liza Minnelli is a love interest, and it's like, I just don't care about a couple of little chubby, rich people,
I'm trying to think, when was it, 81? Was it 81 or?
Yeah.
I saw it, and we laughed a lot, you know, but I was like, I think I was like 10 or 11 at the time. It was a very funny movie. I remember watching it.
You know, I still laugh a lot at it, but I think it's very funny. But this goes back to the conversation that we just finished having about comic actors that are very capable of serious work, equally so. Because that movie was written and directed, I can't remember the guy's name. It was Steve. If one of you guys wants to look it up,
I'll look it up. I'm going to use IMDb now because I didn't want to cheat earlier, but I'll use it now. Yeah.
The writer director actually, I think he committed suicide. Not long after he finished that movie.
Okay, Steve Gordon.
Can't imagine why.
Steve Gordon, yeah. And I don't know if alcohol had. I seem to remember that it did.
It was November 27th, 1982. Let me see if I can find
a year out. After the release of Arthur. Yeah.
That's terrible.
It says heart failure.
The label they throw on anybody.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that's what it says on IMDb. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. By the way, everyone that dies, their heart fails. So,
I'll keep that in mind.
That is a very general term, isn't it?
Kind of a qualifier for dying.
his heart stopped.
Yeah.
But I always liked Arthur and Arthur 2 on the Rocks. Do you remember that, guys?
Oh, yeah,
I'm sure you never saw that, Chris, because you hated. You didn't like the first one.
Yeah, why would he go back?
No,
he didn't care about that.
No, I didn't see the sequel, but it's one of those embarrassing sequels, like the Two Jakes or something like that. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. They went back and made that, didn't they?
Yeah.
The Sting 2. Like,
I would think the Sting 2 might take the cake in that one.
The Sting 2 really stunk.
There's some really embarrassing sequels. In fact, we ought to dedicate a show to that at some point, like the most embarrassing sequels. Speed 2 is another one, although the first Speed was not such a great movie, but it was just so embarrassing, like trying it again 4 years later on a boat, you know, like, ugh.
it was William Dafoe with the leeches or whatever those were.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Oh, it's
no,
Speed 2.
I didn't see the Arthur sequel. I didn't see the point, really, to be honest.
Is there a sequel? Is there a sequel? Go ahead.
As being such a big fan of the Arthur movie, what do you think of Russell Brand? What do you think of a remake with Russell Brand? You know, I mean,
I'm not precious I'm not really precious about it, but
I'm getting old. That's all I can think of when I see all these sequels from like my early teens. I'm just like, God, I'm just getting old. Look, it's everything's going to be remade. I mean, okay, so they're going to remake Arthur. Okay, fine, so be it, you know.
Yeah.
I just don't see, for me personally, because I, honest to God, every time I watch Arthur, I laugh and laugh and laugh. I just can't see where I'd have that same reaction to the Russell Brand remake.
Wouldn't you be playing the same character?
I don't laugh at Russell Brand.
He's funny, but it's the same thing already. We got Get Him to the Greek or Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and I would imagine it's just the exact same character.
Well,
kind of.
It's something very individualized, you know. Mm-hmm. I know that Russell Brand's a talented guy. I enjoy watching him in interviews. I actually find him more infectiously energetic and captivating in interviews than I do in films. But it's so individual with senses of humor that I don't think he's funny just simply because I don't laugh at him. He doesn't make me laugh.
Well, let me tell you this. They remade Bedazzled, which I think is probably one of Dudley Moore's funniest films with Peter Cook. They remade that with Brendan Fraser and Elizabeth Hurley. And it just doesn't have the same momentum. It didn't have the same kind. It couldn't. I mean, it really couldn't. Regardless of what you think about Elizabeth Hurley or Brendan Fraser, it just, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore had this great comic timing together in the original film. Very funny movie. And you try to recreate that, it doesn't work. Now, I'm not saying Arthur, I'm not saying these are sacred cows. I don't know if anything's a sacred cow anymore.
No.
You know, so, but I just don't, it was funny. I mean, I think John Gielgud is really like the heart and soul of the original movie. He's great in that. I mean, it's just such, so nice to see this classic Shakespearean actor, you know, let his guard down.
Well, this brings up a good, John Gielgud was a major coup for that movie and a major draw for it. Because here's the most straight-laced proper British actor that you can imagine kind of letting loose, playing on that persona, you know.
Yeah, but he also did Caligula along with every other British actor there, too. I think,
he really let loose in that one, yeah.
Everyone let loose in that one.
Everyone was loose in that movie. But here's an interesting topic. Remakes or sequels that are greater than their originals.
Okay, yeah.
Or that improve upon their originals.
I can think of several off the bat that I think we were all thinking.
The Fly that we were talking about earlier comes to mind immediately. Cape Fear comes to mind immediately. Ocean's 11. That original Ocean's 11 movie is awful. It's almost unwatchable. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but they're all having a good time making that. No, I agree with you, Chris, that it just, I mean, Dean Martin, I don't think he's sober. I don't think he's sober in any shot of that film.
Yeah, no, I doubt it.
But they had a
a documentary on the making of that original Ocean's 11 would be more entertaining than the film.
But do you mean just sequels or remakes, or do you want to include both, or
either one?
Okay, because I think the ultimate, to me, the greatest, one of the great remakes is The Thing.
Yes.
Right.
I think Thing is, I mean, I like the original, don't get me wrong, but the sequels, I mean, the remake is so frightening. Just gets under your skin. As far as sequels, I mean, obviously The Road Warrior, The Godfather 2, maybe. The Empire Strikes Back, definitely.
For me, I mean, definitely Cape Fear. Cape Fear is kind of gives substance to a movie which at its time was an unthreatening potboiler kind of thing.
Well,
the main attraction was seeing somebody straight-laced as Gregory Peck going against the wild man Robert Mitchum.
But I have to say something about that. I do enjoy Scorsese's remake a lot. But I don't, Mitchum, to me, there's just no one quite like Robert Mitchum. But it is, I understand what you're saying, and it's
I adore Scorsese's Cape Fear, and I'll tell you why. I adore Scorsese's Cape Fear mostly for the performance of Nick Nolte and for Scorsese and the themes he's exploring in that. I got to be honest. I never cared for De Niro in Cape Fear.
No.
He never really stood out for me. He didn't offend me, or I didn't dislike him. But
I know what you're saying. The Nick Nolte character, because they bring it's a sense of that it's not like, you know, he's got some secrets too. He's done some bad things, and I like that. That's what I love about the remake, is they changed that.
Well, Scorsese loves the original, too. It's obvious from watching the movie. First of all, because he cast Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum in the movie. That's one of the interesting things about it. And switched up their roles, you know. So.
And I do like Godfather 2. I mean, Godfather is a perfect movie.
Yeah,
I get more nourishment out of Part 2. It just feels like a richer film to me.
Let me ask you this, since we're speaking of, you know, you said that Scorsese loved the original Cape Fear. And, you know, Peter Jackson obviously loved the original Kong. Not the Dino De Laurentiis one, but the original one. Did you think that reverence hurt his film at the end?
Absolutely. Funny you mention that, because I was just watching, about 10 minutes of that movie on TV yesterday, and I think his love of the original movie is absolutely what killed him with that movie. And I like his remake of King Kong.
Yeah.
But there's one big problem with it. It's too fucking long. Like, way
it's
too
really
long for a King
Kong.
It is very long.
And the problem, where it's long at is not on the island. Where it's long at is getting to the island. It doesn't get to the island until, like, over an hour into the movie, and there's all this minutia about the movie that he's making and the production company and why he has to get this actress instead of that one and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you literally could have started it with them all on the boat without all that previous story. None of that mattered. Like, his motivations for making this movie didn't matter. It was enough that he was just a crazy filmmaker that really wanted to do everything. You didn't need to know why and all this kind of stuff. That's what hurt him. And all that stuff is based from his love of the original movie.
Right.
When I saw it, I did divide it up into acts. And I said the first act is just a chore to get through. Mm-hmm. The second act, for me, was the most enjoyable. And the third act, just a little less so for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Yeah. Wow, a unanimous agreement among the three movie geeks.
No, but I agree with you. It shouldn't take that long. It just shouldn't take that long to get to Skull Island. Even in the De Laurentiis one, it doesn't take that long. I mean,
we want to hear from you guys out there. We're going to pick up Dean's line real quick so he can give us his take on the best remakes and sequels, some that might even surpass their originals. But if you feel like calling in and giving your take on what you think belongs on that list, the number is 718-508-9477. And remember, we're accepting a lot of phone callers on this Wednesday night show, 10 p.m. Eastern, because it's nothing but movie trivia. And we want plenty of listener involvement in that.
Yeah.
All right. Dean, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm with you.
All right. We want you to weigh in on this topic, remakes and sequels.
Well, sequels, first of all, you've mentioned a lot of the ones that are really great. I would go with Bride of Frankenstein over Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. True, good one.
Toy Story 2 over Toy Story 1.
And Toy Story 3 over both.
I don't feel that way, Chris. I feel like almost everything that needs to be said about that, about the subject at hand, which is growing up and leaving the past behind and all that stuff, is pretty much said in Toy Story 2, and I feel like Toy Story 3, while entertaining, it doesn't really add a whole lot to the subject.
Chris and I are just alike because both of us saw it, but neither one of us remember a thing about Toy Story 2. Isn't that right, Chris?
It did not affect me at all the way that and neither did the first one, for that matter. Neither of those first two affected me as much as the third did.
How old were you guys when you saw it?
We were like four.
I remember the day exactly.
I was 25 when I saw the first one.
Yeah, I think I was like 15 when I saw the first one. I was probably like 20 when I saw the second one, and I saw the third one, you know, this year. So,
do you think that had any kind of effect on like how you reacted to each one of the movies?
The death of childhood thing.
Yeah, I think that's
possible.
Invalid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's possible.
Sure. I really felt like I think that. Toy Story 2, which I think it did, I think the age at which I've seen all of these movies has had an effect. And as far as Toy Story 2 goes, I think it hit that sweet spot in my life where I was starting to feel more, perhaps more nostalgic about my childhood days than I am now. So
yeah, I can understand that. Yeah.
No, I understand that. I mean, the Toy Story 3, though, just really sort of the themes expressed in that just sort of really hit me about death and everything and about it just a lot. Just also given the time that I saw it, I mean, it really hit me. I like the other two a lot, but it's just a lot had happened in my life the week before that really just hit me about the third one. And I won't lie to you, that definitely affected. I mean, there are certain parts of Toy Story 3 that I cried just uncontrollably during.
It works the opposite way too, where I can be at a certain years later, I'll watch a movie that I didn't like upon first viewing, and I'll be, what did I miss there?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's right.
This is very important. It's very important to, like, it's almost, you know, so important that it feels like, I wonder why a lot of film writers don't mention these things, you know? I would like a lot of film writers to talk about how movies, where they've occurred in their lives and things like that, because I think that's important. But at any rate, Dawn of the Dead over Night of the Living Dead.
True. Very true.
Hey, how about Chris Nolan's Insomnia over the original Insomnia? In my opinion, probably a better movie. Although I love the first one. I think his is just like the Cape Fear remake. It's a little bit, it's got some more dimensions to it. The performances are a little bit more realized. And I do think it's easier to respond to movie to a movie when it's in your native language. I think sometimes that we see movies that are foreign, and we can respond to them very well, but you can't pick up on the awkwardness of someone's performance if it's not in your own language. And that brings us to an interesting point, because there's a couple of high-profile remakes that will be coming out very soon, the first one being Let the Right One In, which is being remade as Let Me In, which... They pissed me off already. Like, I don't mind that they're remaking the movie, but it does piss me off quite a bit that they changed the title in that way, because the title kind of means something. And I don't think that Let Me In is just kind of one-dimensional. It doesn't mean anything.
That's a good point, Chris. That's a very good point.
I don't think that's a remake that I don't think stands a chance of being as good as the original. And then there'll be the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo remake, which I think stands a very good chance of being as good, if not better, than the original.
I love the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I don't have a problem with Daniel Craig casting that role, or the rumored Natalie Portman, even though
it's not Natalie Portman. They're saying it's someone we don't know, someone we aren't familiar.
Well,
with.
If it's an unknown,
that's better.
That's better. But it's funny that you bring up Let the Right One In relation to the original Insomnia. Because they're both obviously foreign films that depend more than language. They depend on mood and atmosphere. The Nolan Insomnia is an Americanized remake in the best way. You know.
But that won't be true with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because they're going to take place. They will be shot in Scandinavia.
But made by David Fincher, an American filmmaker.
I love David Fincher. I don't know. I don't understand. I mean... I wouldn't bother. I mean, I know they're going to remake them. I mean, obviously, they want... I mean, because Americans don't like to read subtitles is the...
The original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was not based on... Its appeal wasn't based on mood and atmosphere. I mean, those were characters. It was based on the strength of a really pleasurable, readable novel. That's how the movie felt, actually.
But that it does seem like... I mean, they're both... So far, the two that I've seen are very good. I just think it's so... Look, they're going to be remade, and if Fincher directs all three of them, then that's fine. I have no problem with that, because I think he, more than any other director, will probably get and maybe bring something new that the other director didn't.
I am relieved that Fincher's doing it instead of, you know, Stephen Sommers or somebody.
That's always a plus. Stephen Sommers.
How about this? Superman 2 over Superman.
I think Superman actually has more to it in terms of just its scope and everything. But Superman 2 is almost there in terms of entertainment. You know, on an entertainment level, I would say, yeah, they're running neck and neck. But I feel like Superman, the first Superman in 78, is a little bit more of a better film. I just love all those Smallville scenes in Superman. I just feel like those alone are raising up to greatness. So.
What about the obvious one, The Dark Knight over Batman Begins?
Oh, yeah. I like Batman Begins better.
I love Batman Begins. I love both of them. It's hard to really pick.
Hey, here's a remake that when you mention remakes, it's hard for me to like think of any remakes, because you already talked about The Fly already in this, and that's of course a great remake. How about and I have a sequel too. How about The Fugitive? Would that count as a remake?
Yeah,
but
kind of. I mean,
a big screen version of the television show. Yeah.
Right.
I'm sure that the film is. How about what?
Where do those fall in terms of what to call them? You know, like, are they remakes or? It's hard to say, but I like The Fugitive at the very least. Aliens versus Alien.
That's an interesting case because it's almost not fair because they're completely kind of different genres.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes it in a completely different direction.
I would say
they're in their prospective genres, they're equally as effective and accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, what would you say?
I don't know about that. I think that Aliens is very accomplished, but ultimately is an action movie. And there had been action movies that were at least well done made prior to it, and very, very similar. Alien was something that had not been accomplished quite like that ever. Alien was the first of its kind, and there were not any movies really comparable to it in any way, shape, or form prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was
Alien. I love them both.
Alien is kind of is sort of an unofficial remake of a '50s movie called It: The Terror from Outer Space.
Right.
I'm talking about the film style, not the what it was based on.
I mean, the thing was based on a movie of a guy with a rubber mask on too, and we had lots of those in the '50s. You know, someone with a couple of rubber claws and a rubber mask running around chasing a bunch of white dudes through.
Yeah.
You know, a building somewhere. That's not what Alien is. It's not the same thing at all.
Yeah, it's true. But if you go back and take a look at it, you'd be surprised. I'm talking about the one from the '50s. You'd be surprised at how similar they are. But of course, they're not in any way stylistically. The Ridley Scott movie is world.
All right. Which is the best Lord of the Rings in the opinion of the three of you?
Oh boy.
Well, they're sort of inseparable.
I have to agree with
you. As far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Yeah,
There's no real different mood between any of them.
Yeah. And it's a continuing story, Chris.
Yeah.
So one completes the other.
Right. There's not really a different kind of style between one movie to the others. There's not really a different mood. In fact, the mood of one is dependent on having seen the prior and is also dependent on seeing the following one.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of an accelerating dread as you watch them, and it's sort of meant to be seen back to back to back. They only were released in triplicate because, you know, you'd make more money that way. But I guarantee you, if you talk to Peter Jackson as a filmmaker, if he'd had his way, he would rather have them all three out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Would the same criteria apply to the Bourne films?
I don't think so. I don't think so. First of all, there's other Bourne movies or books that were written where they're not
that are after those, and they're loosely. I think the smartest thing Tony Gilroy did was drop the Cold War stuff. Cut all that
out.
Yeah,
but it's about Bourne trying to find out where he came from. I mean, his identity and what brought him. Each one builds upon the other.
It is one solid story,
and I will say that when I get in the mood to watch a Bourne movie, I start with the first one and I end with the third one. I don't necessarily have to watch them all in the same day, but I don't ever just put the Bourne ultimatum in. I just can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you're right, Jamie.
That's a good point, but I do love that. I think the second one steps it up a notch big time. I mean.
And then you have the strange case of the Matrix films, which has there ever been a fall off a cliff like the second and third Matrix movies from the first?
Yeah,
I can't think of one.
That's a big steep cliff that they go off of. And the sad thing is, I think there are good things in both sequels. I'm not saying, I mean, like everyone, I was disappointed with Reloaded, but I think there's good elements, good parts of 2 and 3, but there's just not enough there for one solid good movie in either case. They're interesting sequences and stuff, but on the whole, they just at the end of the day, they don't add up to anything.
Who goes back and watches that second or third movie? I mean,
there are people who do.
There are people that want to who really do, but the problem is, I think they're so obsessed with making a trilogy.
Yeah.
They are founding, so there's so much filler in both of those sequels. I would have focused more on making just a better second film, trying to make a really better second film and seeing what you had there, because I think this is a case, and this happens with everyone, doesn't matter who you are,
when filmmakers believe their own hype or artists believe their own hype, and when that happens, you have someone like Joel Silver, who in Wired magazine said, "We raised the bar so high there is no bar anymore." That was right before Reloaded came out.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you start this kind of hubris, you fall on your ass, and it happened to them.
Right.
Yeah,
Terminator 2
producer?
Over the original. Yeah, yeah. He's kind of grandiose anyway. He's a lot like Don Simpson without the drugs, you know.
That's good. I like Don Simpson
drugs. Terminator 2 over Terminator over the original.
I personally like the original better, but I find that the original has that sort of B movie quality that I enjoy a lot. It has that kind of graininess to it, and I feel like it's just a straightforward action movie as opposed to a screed about, you know, what might happen in the future with technology running amok and that kind of thing. I like Terminator 2. It's just sort of a above average action movie, but I don't believe that it's the, you know, landmark film that Terminator was.
I don't know about that. I love the first Terminator movie, and I love them both. But if you go back and watch that first Terminator movie, there's some really shitty acting in that movie.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I like that B movie kind of quality to it.
Well,
you sound like you like
a lot of B movies, be it from the 50s
or from the
80s. Like, but
well,
and that's fine. I like those
of
kind
of
movies
stuff.
Too. But the second one had a little bit more to say, and the acting was a little bit stepped up, and, you know, it had some comedy in it and stuff. The first one's very, very cheesy at parts. It's good, but it's extremely cheesy.
And actually, the original is, it was done in the 50s as the Big Eye from Outer Space. I don't know, I just made some up. Evil Dead 2 over the original.
Ooh, yeah.
I would go with that.
Yeah.
I would go with that.
Mm-hmm.
I would take it one step further. Actually, I would go Army of Darkness over Evil Dead.
Yeah, I would have to. Yeah, I was going to say that too. I love Army of Darkness. Love that.
I like Army of Darkness, but quite a bit. But there's nothing like Evil Dead 2. I mean,
except
Army of Darkness. here's some other options. Hang on, some other choices here. X-Men 2 over the original.
I go with that, yeah.
Star Trek 2 over the original.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a no-brainer.
Yes.
No offense to Robert Wise, but that's a no-brainer.
Here's the list of best remakes. The Thing, The Fly, those are obvious. This guy chose the King Kong, Peter Jackson, which I wouldn't agree with that.
No, I wouldn't
agree with that. Scarface, that's an interesting...
Yeah.
No.
I go with the Paul Muni one. As much as I do love Scarface, the Al Pacino one, but I'd have to go with Muni on that one.
I absolutely go with the Brian De Palma version.
Okay, now that's cool. No, that's
too.
Cool. I understand that.
A singular vision, whereas the Paul Muni is just another gangster movie. There were a lot of them made very similar to that. Scarface is unique in a way that no movie was like that at that time. Took the bar. Did what Joel Silver said, you know, took the bar away.
Right. Okay. No, I understand that, Chris.
I believe that if you pay attention to history, you'll find that the original Scarface took the bar away.
The original Scarface
then.
Was a big deal in its day. I mean, that it was very controversial when it came out.
For you now, maybe it looks like everything else, but back then it wasn't.
Yeah, you know, fucking Fatty Arbuckle was awesome back in the day too, and now he's.
Yeah, I mean, come on, stop pissing on the past.
No.
Oh, that's right. Deed's pissing on the past argument.
I can't
stand that. I'm not pissing on the past. Look, I like those kind of things. I also don't like when people jerk off on the past. Like, you know, like, we don't need to do that either. Like, it was good.
Yeah,
someone came along and did something better. When if it wasn't better, we wouldn't even be talking about whether it was better. Someone makes something that's not as, when something's not as good, like the King Kong remake, we say immediately, no, not as good. But if there's a chance that it's as good or better, then we have a conversation about it. We don't have that conversation about King Kong.
Scarface is overrated. Let's face it.
No, I'm not going to face it.
It is a little bit.
Scarface is the defining movie of the 80s. I think it's the best movie about consumerism and materialism in America in the Reagan era.
I don't know.
Well, you should know, because I just told you.
He prefers movies from the 1880s.
I find that movie is replete with its own sort of really bad acting, and actually goes overboard in a way that's funny. So you're laughing.
Well, that's the point. The movie is about excess.
I understand what Dean's right and Jamie's right. I mean, on this, I mean, Scarface. It's really funny that to a younger generation, born in the 90s and everything, Scarface means very little. But I understand what it is about. No, the film is about excess. Excess on every level, and that the film does very well.
Thomas Crown Affair, the remake. I would say, and here I am going to piss on the past, I would say I like the remake a lot better than the Jewison film.
Yeah.
I actually do, too.
Yeah, I mean, the Steve McQueen one, as much as I love Steve McQueen, when I watched it again a while ago, it just felt horribly dated.
It's boring.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Having said that, the poster for the original is one of the greatest posters.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Well, that's true, and also I like a lot of the split screeny stuff in the original and stuff. So I like some of the stylistic in the original, but as a whole, I like the remake better.
And the Pierce Brosnan one was very good, yeah.
I'm fair.
Yeah, you are fair. We love you, Dean. Don't worry.
Here's a remake that no one would argue is superior, I don't think, among us, and that's Demme's The Manchurian Candidate.
Oh, yeah, nobody would do that. Although, you know, I didn't think it was as bad as I was expecting, you know, the Demme remake.
I didn't either. I like the remake, and I also don't think that the original is so hot. Like, I'm not one of these people that thinks the original. But I would not argue that the remake is better.
My only problem with the remake is it wants to be something. And it just loses it starts off with a lot of promise, I think, the first half, and it gets muddled. It doesn't understand what it loses its focus halfway through.
It does.
I do like the idea of the remake. I won't lie to you.
It does what a lot of remakes do, which is it tries to have it both ways.
Yeah.
It tries to go off in its own direction, but it also wants to hang on to these jewels from the original movie.
Yeah, and it can't do that with the story it's trying to tell.
And
right.
It's also not particularly the original movie is visually like amazing to look at, and this one's sort of just blah. It's just sort of bad.
I don't know.
Kind of
amazing to look at.
No, it is.
Of course it is.
I mean, come on.
Are you telling me
visually amazing?
Are you telling me that
we've got words like amazing for a reason? We've got words like amazing for a reason.
It is.
That's not an amazing movie. Yeah, that's not an amazing movie. Again, let's just throw it into the pile.
No. That's not what I'm saying.
It is.
Okay, Chris, what do you say?
Go ahead and hang up on him.
No, I didn't. I didn't hang up on him. I just muted you. I'm trying to. All three of you guys are talking at once, and I just want some clarity.
Believe me, I'm well aware of that. You know, we've got words like visually amazing for a reason. Now the movie is good, well shot, but I just don't think we need to throw around words like visually amazing. You know, like it's not visually amazing. It's a good looking movie. The original, but let's not start jerking each other off about it. You know, it's
not up there with Avatar
right.
as a visually amazing
right.
film.
Right, we have words like visually amazing for movies like Avatar. You know, for movies that are shot like that are visually amazing.
Okay, all right. Let me have a little bit of time here.
Okay.
The
and then we'll get you, and then we'll get Jerry.
Okay,
the opening sequence to Manchurian Candidate. It's one of the best edited, best art directed, one of the most well shot sequences taking place in both a communist gathering of top level communists and a ladies auxiliary meeting. This is one of the greatest opening scenes in movie history, and the movie is filled with scenes like that. From the scene with Sinatra and Lee on the train together, which is probably one of the most unusually written scenes, to its climax, to almost everything with Angela Lansbury in it,
mm-hmm.
everything that has anything to do with television, the television screens that are used in it, is brilliant. There is nothing very amazing about visually. There's nothing even worth noting visually in the remake. Again, you know, go back and take a look at it. See, I think Chris has a problem with older movies because he doesn't like that kind of acting. He doesn't like that kind of, like, burgundy acting. You know, he likes his acting to be more real. Therefore, he gets more into it. And I would say the same thing that Kubrick says about real acting, quote-unquote real acting. Yes, is it real, but is it interesting? It might be real, but yes, is it interesting? So, anyway, I'm making an assumption about that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
you know what you do when you make an assumption.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Dean, you shouldn't have said assumption.
I know.
I feel
can't
like
use that damn word anymore.
I know. I don't know.
Okay, Jerry.
Okay.
Do you have thoughts on this argument?
I do have thoughts because the film is very important. It was in shown for a long time. The film was very controversial.
That's ironic because it's not being shown these days much either.
I have a VHS copy if you want to borrow it, Chris.
I own it.
Okay, I know. I understand where Chris is coming from, and I also understand where Dean is coming from, but there is something really... I love Lawrence Harvey in this film, and I'm not just saying that because Domino Harvey was so fucking cool while she was alive, but there is a lot of that in there, obviously, but Lawrence Harvey was just, in his performance, and also the film, the effect the film had on films like The Parallax View and all the President's Men, and all the great paranoid thrillers of the 70s, I mean, we owe
right.
that to The Manchurian Candidate. We might not have those films if it was not.
Well, I think we probably owe it more to Watergate and Vietnam.
Oh, we owe it, but I mean, it was Manchurian.
But it was the first. It was the first kind of paranoid. It was a really early paranoid thriller, from the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really was, and of course of course by today's standards, a lot of the great films of that time and well before that must seem very dated to a lot of kids today. They can't...
kids like Chris.
Chris, I understand where Chris is coming from, but it must seem odd to... This is... All right, I want to bring something up after this, but I actually think both are valid points, but I have to go with Dean on this one.
Here's my point. Movies have to be viewed as being part of the time that they are made in. You know, and appreciated in that way as well.
Right.
As kind of universal entertainments that can last throughout the generations. A lot of these classic movies are best appreciated in that frame of mind, the time that they are made in. And generations pass, new blood comes in, and it's quite possible for that new blood to one-up the previous generation's work. I mean... The growth of an art form, what else is it for except for that? I think, since we've been talking about De Palma a lot lately, I think De Palma in many ways one-ups Hitchcock. And as a critic pointed out to us during the interview, probably a generation from now, somebody will one-up De Palma. That doesn't lessen Hitchcock's films by saying that you appreciate De Palma's some of his work and what he did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we're all on the
same
point.
You're exactly right. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Someone did something first doesn't mean they did it the best. You know, I mean, that's an important conversation, just like we're having with remakes and sequels,
mm-hmm.
and especially as it pertains to things like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Okay, this was a book. Let's not give these filmmakers of this movie too much credit. You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is a book that was written. They didn't fucking come up with this shit.
Yeah,
you know, like
global phenomenon.
There's a dead weed that came up with this stuff. So.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, I've liked essentially all of the movies. I like the 70s the best.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Kaufman. I think because that was bred again, it's informed by the time it is made, and it's
right.
inbred with such visceral. You know, all the stuff that the paranoid thrillers of the 70s are built on.
Yeah, that's a great remake, too. I mean, that is another one of those excellent, I think, that really builds on it and
takes it further because the ending.
And I'm sure the original is informed by I'm thinking communism and that
yeah.
kind of thing. Yeah.
And
so, okay.
And it in its time, you know, it was considered scary too. At any rate, you know, I'm not saying that everything that's old is better than everything that's new, but I would say I always try and tell people to who are not sure that they want to go and take a look at older movies because they're not sure that they'll be able to relate to them. I'll say, have you ever wanted to be in a time machine? Have you ever wanted to see what life was like back then, what mm-hmm. things looked like, how people dressed, how what cars looked like and what people, you know, how people's houses looked and stuff like that? I mean, that's a... Movies are very much sort of a time machine for that. And if you just
right.
look at these older movies as going back and just getting just it's a present day filmmaker, but he somehow has the wherewithal to create the greatest period detail you could possibly imagine. If you just look at them like that,
right.
and realize that acting was a little different and stuff like that, then you can enjoy them.
And let me bring up some remakes that might not be so obvious that in some ways are worse or better. The first one that comes to mind is a remake that's equally I like because I saw it first, but the remake of Burt Lancaster film Crisscross, The Underneath, Steven Soderbergh's The Underneath with Peter Gallagher. I think
right.
that's a good. I think it's a very interesting remake. And speaking of the time period and everything, I think both work. Both are very good. I think here's one that's a shocker. I think the remake of Greta Garbo's The Painted Veil is far superior, the one that came out a couple of years ago with Naomi Watts. That's actually better. The one with Greta Garbo, if you remember, was just savage when it came out. People really hated that film. I think that actually works a little bit better than the Garbo one. But then there's something like Against All Odds, which is a remake of Out of the Past, which it just, regardless of the car chase,
yeah.
it can't touch Out of the Past. So
yeah.
It varies from film to film, I think.
Yeah. The Birdcage, by the way, is another one.
Yeah.
The Birdcage, yeah, that's a good choice.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
Good choice. Something that surpasses the original.
Yeah, by far. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Against All Odds is kind of, there's a lot of ridiculousness in that.
Yeah, there is, but I mean, no, it is, I mean, I do love that car chase, and that's the one thing I remember. About.
Yes, and I remember the Pauly Kael review that started, God, I've come to loathe car chases. That was
yeah.
her first sentence of that review. But
yeah.
you know, Against All Odds, I just can't get beyond, you know, they're all sweaty, they're making love in this Mayan cave
yeah.
or something,
yeah.
and then out of the blue, Alex Karras walks in.
Yeah, what's up with that?
The most ridiculous thing ever.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah, okay. Any other topics we want to discuss before we close out?
I just wanted to say something I was thinking about the other day, and you'll probably mute me if you want to do that. But I kind of miss the days, and I think Dean might be with me here. We have like 500 channels. We have the internet. We have like the Blu-ray where you can watch all the Netflix movies that you want. You know, the instant thing, instant feature. I miss the days when you had to hunt for films.
Oh yeah.
When you had to wait for them to come on TV, or we can watch whatever we want. And it sort of takes some of the fun out of it.
I still remember this is a good subject, you know, like back in the 70s, like sitting and getting the new TV guide that was
yeah.
this all premiere TV guide.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have a section that was movies. What movies were going to be on this year, you know? This would be like 77, 78 or whatever. And what movies were going to be on the ABC Movie of the Week and stuff like that
right.
this year. And it'd be like, oh, wow, they're going to get All the President's Men or something like that.
Right, right.
All that stuff was very... important, and it was also extremely. I definitely miss the days when there was late night television on almost every major outlet, like WOR in New York,
mm-hmm.
WGN Chicago, WTBS, and
yeah.
they had a
Holy
lot of old
shit.
Movies.
You guys are fucking sentimental. Jesus Christ.
Well,
no,
actually, WGN in some way is responsible for a big moment in my life because that's where I saw the first movie that kind of changed me, and that was Cuckoo's Nest. I taped it overnight when they showed it. And, of course, it was a bad TV, you know, all fuzzy and edited and stuff. But, you know, it really affected me. So I used to tape those WGN After Dark movies.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
the Cinemax After Dark movies, too, by the way.
Well, yeah, of course.
I used to actually tape things on cassette and listen to them.
Yes. Yeah.
You
well,
know,
I wasn't that geeky, but...
Yeah, I used to listen to
but
cassettes of movies.
We take for granted all these... We can watch anything with just a couple mouse clicks or just a couple clicks on the remote, and it's there. And I'm not saying people watch these things. I mean, people of the old... I mean, obviously, something like Turner Classic Movies is, I think, a real great gift and everything. And AMC, back in its day before it became American Movie Crap, was good, too. Before you had TCM, but it just seems like, I don't know, we take everything for granted now. There was a time when your favorite movies weren't even available on VHS, and they were very rarely shown on the deep UHF channels even.
I'm thankful that movies are more readily available now, but by the same token, I also see that it's all about consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so than it probably was. I mean, people wanted the audiences to see their films.
Right.
But it seemed like more of an event to go to the movies years ago. And maybe this approach to consumerism and being so easy to find movies is systematic of them being a little bit more of a disposable kind of...
Mm-hmm.
They're being treated as a more disposable art form now.
Yeah.
I mean, the act of going to a repertory theater is kind of, you know, it's kind of the act of...
Yeah, no, nobody's going to do that.
I don't know people who are doing that.
Chris, what do you think about that, this whole discussion?
Yeah, I don't buy it. Like, I think it's better if it's... Sorry, I hate to be contrary again, but in a summer in a summer where we have bullshit like Prince of Persia and Sex and the City 2 and Shrek 4 and fucking Iron Man 2 and Salt and all this bullshit and Dinner with Schmucks and all these just disposable movies, I have a hard time going, man, I wish the days when I had to look for a good movie. Like, I have a hard time saying that. When Inception is, you know, an island of reality, ironically, in an
right.
ocean of diarrhea that is like modern cinema. I don't know. Like, I don't have this. I know that's sort of a different conversation because you're talking about movies that are, you know, not in the theater. You're talking about, you know, access to movies. I like that. I like that I can hop on Netflix and find a movie that I couldn't find before. You forget there were a lot of those movies that, oh, you had to look for them, but you just couldn't find them a lot of the time. It was like, oh, I want to see that original Paul Schrader movie, Blue Collar. Well, guess what? You couldn't see it because that wasn't on HBO and that wasn't on TV. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was on VHS for a little while, but they never put it on DVD, and I don't think it's on Blu-ray either. But, you know, I mean, now you can probably find that on the Internet somewhere. You can go find a VHS copy.
You can find
of
everything on the Internet now. I mean,
yeah,
but
I like that I can go find those movies now. And I remember being tortured by the fact that I wanted to watch every Cronenberg movie, and I couldn't, you know? Like, now I can. I like that.
I like that, too. I like that, too. But here's a point. If film is to be taken as an art form, and this is expanding upon what I just said earlier, what do people do with art? They collect it. And I think what Dean is talking about is the excitement of trying to track down that rare film, only being able to get it from, like, you know, Great Britain or something, like a region 2 or 1 or whatever it is. And there's joy in that, and it feels like you're... It feels like an investment in the art form, more than pulling it up on the computer and that kind of thing.
I could have said it better. It's like finding a movie and seeing it, whether it was like at the drive-in as a second feature on television late at night or early in the morning at a repertory theater on VHS, an old copy of a VHS, no less. At a rundown old store, that kind of thing was just very. Every time it was like your heart was palpitating. You know, you were like, every time you found it. You know, now the heart doesn't palpitate that much anymore. It's just kind of a
I think you're talking about the joy of finding the movie, and I prefer the joy of watching the movie. I don't care what I have to do to find it. I don't care if I have to go to the store and get it or get it from Netflix or get it from my collection. This just happened to me the other day. I have a collection of hundreds and hundreds of DVDs. Sometimes I don't watch one of them for years and years. So it's a movie that I love and I own, but I haven't seen it for years, and I'll scroll my finger down the list of movies. And the other day I watched Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I saw it in the theater. I bought the DVD when it came out. I haven't seen it since it was in the theater.
Right.
I don't know why. The other day I got a hankering to watch it. You put in a movie like that from your collection that you haven't seen in 10 years or whatever it is, and it's all back when you're watching the movie. I don't give a shit if I got it from Netflix or if I borrowed it from somebody. I remember that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is an awesome movie. So the joy comes from watching it, ultimately. Who cares what you have to go through to find it?
That's kind of what I meant. This is a failure on my part, actually, gentlemen. Because that's kind of what I was talking about. I was talking about something else, but it's a failure on my part to articulate what I was trying to get across from my mind into actual words. You're all right, but you're also all wrong on this. It was just something I noticed. No. We have 5 minutes. I think it's not going to be 5 minutes. It's not going to be 5 hours. Jamie, you might as well just. I'm sorry I brought this up in one sense. I'm glad I brought it up, but I'm.
Well, go ahead and make your point.
No. I just think. I don't know. Maybe it's just my. We talk about things. I just hate when I see. Like, I understand what Chris means about the crouching. Was it Crouching Dragon, Hidden? I don't remember the title of the movie. I've seen so many martial arts movies that my mind gets blurred after a while. It's not Ashes of Time. I don't know what it is. But it's that we have a whole generation that are, like, I guess they're turning 30 or whatever, and they go to the torrents, and that's what they do. They'll never go to the theater. They'll never even buy it. They won't buy it on DVD even, or rent it on DVD. They just go to the computer. And while I love watching the movies and on the TV, I don't even mind anymore. I used to be really adverse to that. It's this whole thing of, you know, oh, I'm just going to go to the torrent. And, you know, it's that, Chris, name your favorite movie recently. Just name me your favorite movie recently.
Inception.
Inception is no different than Grown Ups.
I don't think that's true. I think that's a bullshit argument. Listen,
no,
we
it's
were
not
kids.
A bullshit argument. It's the same thing. It's the same manner of consumption that Inception.
No.
The other day, let me stop you for a second. I have to agree because
Here we go. Old Man River.
I love Inception.
I know. You saw the Paul Muni Scarface. I know.
No. Hold on a minute.
We get it. You like those tropes. We know.
The movie Inception is my favorite movie of this period too, and the other day a whole group of friends wanted to sit down and watch a bootleg copy of it, and I said, No! I will not sit down with you and watch this. This is a movie you need to go out to the theater and see. We're not going to do this.
Yeah.
I said, well, we should not be doing this.
We were movie nerds. The four of us were movie nerds when all of our – not all of our friends were. I had lots of friends who weren't into movies as much as I were. Jerry, you probably had the same thing. Dean, you did. And Jamie, you did too. We all were obsessed with movies. This next generation will be just the same. There'll be – most of the kids will download torrent movies and stuff like that, and it'll all be disposable. Grown-ups is the same as Inception. But there will be kids just like us who are obsessed with movies. My brothers are just like that. They're obsessed with movies. They're obsessive about seeing the collection of every Cronenberg movie. I want to see every Kubrick movie. I want to see all from the greats. There will always be kids like that. There will always be movie geeks like that. It's not going to just go away and everybody's going to think Grown Ups is the same as Inception. That's not true.
I meant
on a consumption level, though, and the watching it, that they would watch. I mean, I'm not. It's like you're watching Inception or Grown Ups or let's go Prince of Persia, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, or whatever, and there's not a difference. They're watching, okay, it's like, hey, I watch this, boom, okay, boom, what's next? And
There is that mentality. And a movie like Inception is clearly not made for them.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's not. But there are people, and I've seen it a lot, that do, there is, they don't, there's no difference to them. But as
for them, type, between those two movies.
No difference is, but Chris is absolutely right. There are,
but
like,
it's always been that,
like,
way. It's always been that way. There were people that thought North by Northwest was the same thing as Houseboat. They thought that there were always people like that.
There will always be those people, and there will always be people like us.
It goes back to this. It goes back to a guy at my gym who went to go see Greenberg, and he's like, I didn't laugh. It had Ben Stiller in it, but I didn't laugh the way I did.
Right.
Eat the Parents.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
That dude is never going to get Greenberg.
Yeah, he's not.
No matter how he sees the movie, whether it's on the computer or on a DVD.
Right.
He'll get a lot of
money, right.
But he won't get Greenberg.
Right. That's right.
Okay, guys. This was a spirited debate.
Yes, it was.
If you miss Robert Duvall, catch him on the replay. He's in the first half hour. Thank you, gentlemen, so much, every one of you.
All right. Good night.
All right. See you later.